I'm thrilled to say that this series of Beyond the Bathroom is sponsored by Skin & Me, the subscription skincare service tailored to provide what your skin needs. Make sure to keep listening for a discount code you won't want to miss. That's for later in the episode. Now on with the show. Hi, I'm Sally Hughes and this is Beyond the Bathroom, where each week I chat to my guests about their relationships with their own appearance. In Beyond the Bathroom, I attempt to get under the skin of my guests' beauty routines and rituals and hope to find out exactly what they see when they look in the mirror. How has their past affected the way they see themselves now? When did they look and feel their best? And how has their relationship with face and body shifted as life has ebbed and flowed? This week's guest is Sophie Ellis-Bextor. Sophie entered the music business at the tail end of Britpop with her group, The Audience. The year after the band split, she had a number one single which launched her solo career. She's made appearances on Strictly, The Masked Singer, and even Neighbours, RIP. Her podcast, Spinning Plates, led to a memoir about her life and career in which she didn't shy away from discussing experiences of sexual assault, coercive control, and sexism. During lockdown, Sophie cheered the nation with her kitchen disco, serving up a unique and utterly charming fusion of club glam and domestic chaos. Now she's not only coming out of the kitchen, but I'm delighted to say, joining me to go beyond the bathroom. Sophie, hi.
Hello, Sally.
Hello, how are you?
I'm good. I'm really good. Yeah, I've been looking forward to talking to you. And actually, there's so much to talk about with all the things you said, you know, that the podcast encapsulates. So I'm excited.
Good. So I suppose what I really want to know is, can you remember the moment where you first became aware of your appearance?
I was, you know, generation before having phones that you can, you know, see your image straight away. So I didn't really have much of a sense of what I looked like probably until I was sort of getting nearer to double figures, really. Because I think when I was small, you know, you might see some printout photos, but I definitely wasn't really thinking about it. And you don't think of yourself in real time, do you? I was always thinking that with the kids, like my kids, they obviously have such an awareness of them. So, you know, you can take a picture and go, look, that's you today. That's that face you're pulling. But yeah, I don't think I really had much of a sense of kind of looking at myself and being like, ah, this is me, until probably I was, yeah, getting near this double figures, I think.
There was a real freedom, wasn't there, in the fact that nobody had phones, that our kind of adolescence wasn't documented in the way that it is now.
Thank goodness for that. I mean, obviously there were mirrors and things, but I just don't think I was thinking about it in terms of, like, you know, my relationship with it. It was just like, oh yeah, that's my face or whatever. But I think I can remember, as I was getting older, having quite a matter-of-fact thing of just sort of assessing myself. Probably everybody does that a bit, when you sort of realize, oh, we're not all one and the same. This is the things about me that are similar to other people. These are things that are different, you know, working yourself out a bit. So yeah, I think that came as I sort of probably approached beginnings of adolescence, I guess.
I wondered if seeing your mother, Janet Ellis, who's obviously a TV presenter and veteran broadcaster, I just wondered if seeing your mother on television, whether that affected your own self-awareness in terms of appearance. Were you very aware that she had to look a certain way and that maybe women had to look a certain way?
I was definitely fascinated by all the, you know, the things that she used to get herself ready for work and for theatre and for going out. Obviously she had her day job going to Blue Peter. And before that, she also used to act in the theatre. So even when I was really little, like, I remember being backstage and literally smell of the grease paint, which I absolutely adored. I thought that was all really exciting. But also from when I was four, she separated from my dad. So she was a single mum with me until I was seven. And so then she was also, you know, having a sort of dating life. And I remember that being really exotic, like the dressing table and all the stuff she'd be using. And, you know, I wonder if my kids have that when I put my hairspray on, they know I'm going out. It's that kind of thing of like, oh, my mum's other life, like where she headed to and what she done. But I mean, she really loves makeup. So I think that definitely passed down to me for sure.
That's so funny about the hairspray, because I always think the smell of Elnett is the smell of good times incoming.
Yeah, exactly.
That's so interesting that you saw that kind of duality of makeup through your mother, because in the theatre, your mother wouldn't have been wearing makeup to look pretty. She would have been doing it to get into character, to become someone else.
Exactly.
I'm wondering if that was inspiring to you and whether you still do that now.
Definitely. And I think, you know, it's echoed in things like Grease, you know, where Sandy has her big makeover at the end of the movie. And just all of that, I just thought it was really exotic and powerful, how it could just transform someone, obviously the way they look, but then in doing so also the way they held themselves, their mood, their stance. I always thought it was really empowering and exciting. And so I would rummage in her makeup bag and put things on. And I know there's a photo of me when I must have been about 3 or 4, and I've put blue face paint, like grease paint, literally all over myself. But I think I just wanted to sort of submerge myself in some of that transforming power.
I know you're still keen on that sense of transformation now, and we'll come back to that. But I wanted to ask you about the sort of self-awareness. You mentioned not until really double figures that you started to become aware of your own appearance, your own face. But also that would have been exaggerated, compounded, if you like, by the fact that you then entered the music industry so young. So I was reading something weird last night about how when you were just 19, Melody Maker magazine voted you the 5th sexiest person in rock. And at such a young age, how did you feel about that? Did early reviews talk a lot about your appearance? And did things like that make you more self-aware, confident, embarrassed than you had before?
I don't remember that specifically, but I do remember the very first interview I ever did. You know, I spent time with this journalist, female journalist. We got on really well. And I think she spent a few days with the band. And this was the first time I'd ever had anyone do a sort of in-depth interview. I think it might have been our first bit of press ever, really. Mm-hmm. And the article, when it was published, started with something like, you know, Sophie walks into the cafe and I'm looking at her and I can't tell, is she ugly? Is she beautiful? Is she old? Is she young? Wow. And I found this really shocking. Firstly, I didn't realize the interview or any sort of analysis started before I'd, you know, the answers we were giving in the interview, which obviously I get that now. But at the time I was like, oh, I thought it was only when the dictaphone was on. But secondly, I thought, oh, I didn't understand I was going to be sort of assessed. And I think I found that really unsettling because I also, you know, teenage girl, I didn't know how I wore, and I definitely felt quite awkward about the way I looked. So I found all that just a bit peculiar, really. It was just a lot of assessment, really. But I think that was the era as well. I don't think, obviously people still do it, but I don't think they would write about it. I don't think it'd be so public now. But then it felt like it was a real kind of, right, let's figure you out. Don't worry. I know you don't know exactly how you feel about yourself, but we're going to tell you. This is our decision of how you look. And I found a lot of that. Yeah, it was a bit jarring, to say the least.
I know exactly what you mean. I became a journalist during that era that you're talking about and worked on a men's magazine. And there was a certain expectation about how women should behave, that they should almost, in order to compete, which they absolutely could not possibly anyway, because it was made impossible for you, but in order to believe you were competing, you had to be more blokey, right? There was that kind of whole definitely. Ladette culture. And that was definitely your era as well. And I was just wondering, how did you feel around that expectation to be a certain type of woman in the 90s?
Well, I think I felt like a bit of an imposter with the whole thing, really, because underneath all the sort of bravado, I always felt really uncool. So I think I felt like I was a bit of a square and I had to sort of try and cover my tracks, really. So, I think I just probably tried to keep up, but it was always a bit exhausting and I always felt like I was going to be found out, really. But looking back, maybe most people felt like that. I think it was just, as you say, that era, that kind of Ladette thing. It was really not a brilliant backdrop, I don't think, for that shift in what was going on in sort of feminine culture. Because I understood that what was really being talked about was sort of equality, but it was a clunky gear change because it was like, we're not saying you want to have, you know, everything fair and equal to the way men have their lives, but we want to be equal to the sort of lowest common denominator. Like, I didn't even want to know blokes like that, let alone be a woman that acted like that. So I found it all a bit peculiar. And it's funny when I was looking back at it, I think for probably our peers, that's I think a lot of us feel the same way about it now that we get to talk about it. And it's quite nice actually that we can have those conversations now, because at the time everybody's too busy pretending they're completely fine with everything. to let on that they're not really dealing with it that well either.
Yeah, there was a lot of kind of pretending that you could down pints of Guinness when actually it made you feel sick. I remember there was quite a long period of, you know, telling a joke and then have a man say it louder after you, the exact same thing, and get the laugh. There was just a lot of that stuff of trying keep up. And as you say, that type of sexism that definitely still exists, but it was just so overt that it would take your breath away, wouldn't it?
Yeah, definitely. 100%. And when I was writing the book, I was kind of looking back through old press clippings and stuff, and I was like, oh wow, I wasn't imagining it. It's really here. Like, I can see it all in black and white. Quite extraordinary, really.
Yeah, it's basically what girls of the 90s talk about whenever they're together, I find.
Yeah, exactly.
We just talk about how bloody awful it was.
Yeah, exactly.
Are there any absolute fashion or beauty stinkers?
Oh yeah.
Disasters along the way that you care to share with us?
Well, for me, it was I can't really blame anyone else. It was I sort of shot myself in the foot by repeatedly going for very bad haircuts. But they were either free or very cheap, and thinking each time, this one's going to be a good one. It started with a trip to, I think they still exist. It was called Mr. Topper's. It's basically a sort of a barber's that I think occasionally cuts women's hair too. And they did £5 haircuts. And I decided that'd be a great idea just before I did the cover, or the shoot for what ended up being the back of the album for the audience. And I went in asking for a bob, and then they went, should we go a bit shorter? And you know, when you're sat in the chair and you're like, yeah, let's do a big change. And I had this very short little crop, and I knew as soon as I'd done it that I'd made a mistake, and I went home and washed it again and tried to put hair clips in. And it was like, no. So after that, growing out a bit, I then got stopped. I lived in Camden at the time, and I got stopped by someone who, they were like scouting for girls to cut their hair as sort of tryouts, really. So it's a student, a trainee at Vidal Sassoon. And my word, he did effectively a sort of rock mullet, which I then went back to rectify by dyeing it blonde. So I just kept repeatedly. It was just bad haircut after bad hairdo. It was terrible, but I really can't blame anyone. I made all those choices myself.
I had many a free haircut in a hairdressing academy. It was such a big thing, wasn't it? And you'd be there for about 7 bloody hours.
Exactly. Yeah.
And it would always be quite bad unless you got like a prodigious talent or something.
Exactly, which I did not, I don't think. And I remember he put half my hair up on my head and then left the bottom half down and then cut that off at sort of ear level to reduce the volume by half. And as he was doing it, he went, oh, it's so nice doing a haircut where it doesn't matter what the client thinks. And I thought, client, I'm pretty sure that's me. I think that's me.
It kind of does matter.
Yeah, it did. I mean, it was so bad. I remember putting my hair in bunches after that for a while. And then one of my girlfriends, when I showed her, she cried laughing. She's just laughing so much, the tears rolling down her cheeks at the shock of my hairdo.
I've been to your house, and I know, like me, you very much have a constant stream of eBay deliveries arriving at your house.
I do.
And I know, like me, you've always been like that, that you're a real kind of secondhand shopper. How important has dressing up been in your life, and when did it become so?
Oh, I think it's always been there from when I was really small. Again, with my mum, from her theatre stuff, she had dressing up clothes, and she had one of those big baskets filled with hats and shoes and dresses. And even the wedding dress she got married to my dad in, she'd had dyed purple and sewn sequins all over it. So I could wear that around the place if I wanted to. So I loved dressing up at home, absolutely loved it, and had a fascination with my mum's wardrobe. And I do think on eBay, I'm often chasing the look of my mum in the 80s, kind of the pastel, you know, big floaty skirts, or, you know, little dresses with pockets, or little jumpsuits. I think I'm just chasing a lot of that. But I think when I came to my own band when I was 16, obviously during the 90s, there was so much support for going to charity shops and getting things secondhand. That was absolutely huge. So I would just go and buy stuff from Camden Market or from charity shops and get bits and bobs and just start collecting. And actually, I still own quite a lot of that stuff now. I've got a box in my dressing room, like on top of the wardrobe, and it's got all things I wore even from back then, which is quite funny. But I think if you like that stuff, it brings you lots and lots of joy, but it also is like a, you never reach the end of it. You know, it's like the path is endless. And every time you walk past a vintage shop, you're like, oh, maybe it's in there waiting for me, that thing I've, and you don't know exactly what it is even, but you just feel like I need to go and just see if it's that coat or that dress or that thing I haven't even thought of, because some vintage clothing's wacky, isn't it? You think, who's even designed this? But it's all out there, and it's democratic because it's often really inexpensive, and it's had a story before you and it'll have a story after you, and I love that.
So you talk really brilliantly in Spinning Plates about the very common occurrence with especially young women of having lived in a coercive, controlling relationship when you were very young. One really common element of a coercive, controlling relationship is this idea of controlling how somebody looks, how they dress, how they express themselves visually. And I was wondering if when you had freed yourself from that, whether that idea of self-expression through fashion and beauty became all the more important to you.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think the sort of clearest, the clearest way I know that to be true is because, the relationship I have with Richard is he's always completely supported however I want to dress up. He'll never say, I don't think you should wear that, or that's ridiculous. And he'll always be just really supportive. And I think, you know, the way that I've been able to really become more and more myself as the years have gone on has been really lovely for me. And some of that's, you know, still been relatively recent. I think even during the kitchen discos, really, it was like, actually, there's this side of me that I don't normally put out into the world. And it was like, okay, I will wear these ridiculous majorette costumes I've bought off eBay or this ice skating thing or whatever it's I've been storing up. So it's kind of all out there now. But yeah, I think when I was younger, I mean, I think it started with little things like when I was in my teens, little comments about how I'd peaked already, or I was looking old, or maybe, you know, getting a bit chubby here and there and things like this. And they just start to chip. And it's, I think the reason I have no qualms about writing about it or talking about it, because I think that was one of the really nice things about writing the book, is that you feel like, actually, you know, I can have all these conversations now. I'm a grown up. That was a really long time ago. And I don't feel kind of under its spell anymore. It's in the past. But I think hopefully it's nice for people to remember that, you know, it can sort of happen to anybody, really. And it's not like something necessarily, it starts off big and dark and heavy. It can just be tiny little things that insidious. And then they just make you just under the bar, and then the bar goes a bit lower. And I think, yeah, I definitely think there was a caution about the choices I was making, and certain things that would not be supported or encouraged. So now I just completely exploit the fact that that's not part of my life anymore, really. Much to my children's dismay, really. but now I'm just like, probably, I feel like the last few years have been sort of the most, the gap between me with my work and me at home, it's not really there anymore. Whereas there used to be a bigger gap, because I think probably in those days, going to work and dressing up and doing all of that was probably the time when I felt like I could really go for it, because I was in part of a family of people all working together for the same thing.
Is there a part of it that makes you feel like that girl who was sexually assaulted or in a coercive control, that kind of now you can give her the right to reply when she was sort of silenced for so long?
Oh, definitely. Absolutely. I mean, I think it's funny because just before the book was published, I was a bit, you know, apprehensive. And then I thought, actually, no, this is like going back to sort of 17-year-old me and being like, don't worry, this is the other half of that conversation. We can have it now. And actually, on a much bigger platform and in a much probably more sort of significant way, you know, you get your voice gets louder, doesn't it? And I think it's also the power of evolution of language. I think maybe certain aspects of you know, right and wrong have got more nuanced and more articulated now. I don't know if maybe those gray areas were really explored in the same way. We were still learning. I mean, this was still in the era of, I mean, I remember doing an interview with a journalist who also took pictures of me during the interview, and I'd worn a dress that was a bit tight and I had the wrong pants on. So I'd quickly take, and this is very not me, I'm normally someone who's firmly in the pants category, but I had taken them off just because I thought it looks wrong with the dress and it's embarrassing. and he'd taken pictures, and I didn't realize he could see straight on my skirt, and that got published in the newspaper. Like,
yeah.
And that, but now that's literally against the law, but that's, yeah. that's, you know, we were still dealing with that stuff as well. So I think all aspects of sort of what we now say is a you know, a red flag, or things that we think, oh, that's a bit concerning. We're so much better at talking about that now. We have those conversations a lot better now.
I mean, that's a flat out violation of
yeah,
you.
It was pretty crummy.
You wrote very frankly and generously about the all too common occurrence of sexual assault in your book, Spinning Plates. I was wondering if you could share, as much as you feel comfortable, of course, whether that affected your self-image for a while thereafter.
Oh, I think undoubtedly, because it's all one and the same. And I think probably I was a lot more, like, if you'd met me then, I probably would have been a lot more guarded, probably not being particularly open. I think you, when you're sort of, when there's a sort of routine of feeling like you could be easily, very easily humiliated by people who are supposed to be on the same team as you, like publicly, I think your guard goes up quite a lot. And I just don't think I was 100% the same person. I mean, I don't mean to take it really far, because I've always had an amazing group of girlfriends. I've got an amazing family. We're really close. But I think in that time when I was still sort of finding my feet, in terms of what I wanted to put out into the world. And I'd also been quite hurt probably by what happened in my first band, because we got dropped before I was 20. So yeah, I think I probably was just a lot more insecure, basically. And then I think when you move on from that and you start actually having proper fun all the time, working with people who are really lovely and going home to people who were lovely, you just learn that it's okay to put all those boundaries down. But that happens to lots of people, doesn't it? I think a lot of that is quite a normal trajectory, even if it's less dramatic. I think just getting to that bit in your mid-20s where you can start feeling like, oh, actually, I'm a little bit more accepting of the person I am.
Yeah, and kind of finding your groove. You mentioned your family and your friends and your husband. I know you're from a very large, elastic, kind of blended family with step-parents and step-siblings who you're very close to. Do you think too much is sort of your comfort zone?
Well, it's funny, because when I started out, like when I was born, it was just mum, dad, me. That was it.
Yeah.
And I think the really significant bit was when my brother was born. So that's when I was 8. And then I was absolutely obsessed with my brother, Jack. And also my mum was then in a very happy relationship with my stepdad, John. And so that was like a new beginning. And having this baby, I would literally just carry him around on my hip all day. I think, yeah, that kind of hardwired something in me of like, babies are good, family is good. And from then it just kept getting larger and larger. And yeah, now I have 3 sisters and 2 brothers. But it started out just I was on my own till I was 8. It's quite funny to think back, really. That was the beginning.
Yeah, that's so funny, isn't it? This sort of magic baby, because babies can be so magic in a life, can't they? That yeah. This kind of magic baby came along, and you've subsequently had 5 magic babies of your own.
Yeah, crazy woman.
When I read Spinning Plates, I was really interested in the subtitle of the book, which is Music, Men, Motherhood and Me. That's a lot. And you, like most women, have automatically put yourself last, because you've got too many plates spinning, right? So how do you maintain a sense of self-identity, I suppose, in such a large, busy family of 6 with all the challenges that brings?
I think it has to be through my work. I mean, I think if you're lucky enough to be a creative, then it's a huge part of how you balance yourself, having that outlet and that expression. And I really noticed its role massively during lockdown, because I don't have any space at home that's for work. I'd always maintained that because my work demands a lot of me, I felt like at home should be just right here. I'm accessible. I'm always accessible. And then suddenly it was like, actually, I think I'm a little bit too accessible. And I had no headspace. And I found that really tricky. But it also made me understand, like, I mean, and this must have happened for so many people, but obviously during lockdown, everything became so distilled. You know, you were either doing your work bits or you were doing your domestic bits, but there was none of that bit like the commute or grabbing a coffee or bumping into someone on the street and just having a 5-minute chat, all those little casual bits of life. And I realized it's the casual stuff that actually makes, that's actually the glue. That's the bit you need. Like, I've just come back from a weekend of festivals and the gigs were wonderful, but the gigs were only, you know, 2 hours out of the weekend. The rest of it was being with people and catching up with the rest of the band and laughing about stuff and coming up with ideas and all of that stuff. And missing that was massive for me. So, yeah, I think work is my place. And so that's why the kitchen discos became significant, because I could be doing the laundry or bathing the kids, but in my head, I was learning the lyrics for the new cover I was going to do on Friday, or working out another song or trying something. It just gave me a little room in my head. I think I just needed that place to go.
Also, I suppose becoming somebody else, well, not somebody else, but a different version of you, putting on a Supergirl outfit or a sequin catsuit and just and having that moment. How kind of important did you realize that would be such a release for you at the time? Because I think it was for lots of people, putting on the lipstick and coming to your disco, albeit virtually.
Yeah, well, I think when the lockdowns all first started, I just thought we don't really need I don't really need to be reflective. I'm spending a lot of time looking at the news. It's very intense, it's heavy, it's pretty scary. I need a bit of light relief. I need something other. I need to be a bit silly. Silliness was in short supply, really. So I think that's what I loved about being able to get dressed up and just, putting my rollers on, getting my makeup out, spending time on eBay, looking at fun outfits, planning stuff. I really enjoyed all that. I mean, for the kids, it was a very small thing we did. It would just be, we're going to have a disco on Friday if you fancy coming. You know, we'd sometimes talk about it, but not really. But for Richard and I think it just gave us a little bit of a purpose outside of the domestic. And we both really, really thrived on that, I think. And then finding this community through it was really special. I can't really explain it, because it wasn't like I was doing it because I'm a singer as a day job. It went much deeper than that. It was like, this is actually me and what I need. So everybody that came round, everybody that connected with it, it was like we were all kindred spirits, and I just adored it. Like, it was really, really special. And even, now if someone comes up to me and says, oh, I came round, I'm like, that's so crazy. You've been over to my house, but thank you for coming.
It was silly and it was glamorous and it was escapism, but also it was ever so domestic. I think people found it comforting to see, I remember watching it one day, and at one point you were singing, you had a mic in one hand, then you were trying to scoop up a baby who was kind of about to fall off the face of the earth in another arm. Mm. And then there were children like banging into cameras and cushions falling on the floor. And, and it was that kind of chaos. And I remember thinking, do you ever get any privacy at home? Like, do you have moments where you're ever on your own? For example, are you a bathroom door locker?
No, I mean, it's so annoying. Like, our last house had a bathroom with no door. So it was like off the bedroom, and it just had a arch you'd go through. I was like, next house, definitely a door. Now it's got a sliding door. So that's fine, but it doesn't lock. So I've really got to plan this better. No, I'm not really a bathroom door locker. I don't mind that too much, but I do love time for myself. And if I do get time to myself, oh, I absolutely love it. I'm actually very good at being in my own company. If Richard's got to go away for work for a night, I'm like, that's actually quite cool. I can just watch my stuff. He always finds it funny because he's set up the house with quite a lot of techie things. But if he's gone, I'll literally just put something on my laptop, sit on my bed, eat food on a tray. Like, I'm quite like lo-fi, but it's really comforting. I absolutely love it. It just doesn't happen very often.
Skin and Me, our brilliant sponsor here on Beyond the Bathroom, is a subscription skincare service tailored to provide exactly what your skin needs. Each month, you'll receive a personalised dermatologist-designed solution packed with wonderful active ingredients you can't buy over the counter, delivered in a metered dispenser called the Daily Doser. I can vouch personally for both the service and the doser because I myself have been a paying Skin and Me subscriber for almost 2 years, and I wouldn't be without it. It takes around 12 weeks to reveal your best skin. Whether your goal is to banish breakouts, soften fine lines, ditch the foundation, or you want a great-looking base for makeup, see what you can achieve when you introduce actives into your nightly routine. Beyond the Bathroom listeners can trial their first month of Skin and Me for just £3.50. Just use the code SALLYHUGHES. That's SALIHUGHES.
So, Sophie, I ask all guests what their skin and me moment is. You know, that moment of self-care when you shut the door on the world. What does that look like for you?
Yeah, I would take that. I think some people don't have tellies in their bedroom, but I really love it. Telly in bed, yeah, that is blissful to me. Or playing on my Game Boy, I'm still very happy with that. But if I do get time on my own in the bathroom, that's lovely. I mean, a bath is, that's luxurious to me now. I'll put some nice essential oils in and make it smell nice. And actually, I don't know why I've done this, but once the kids get to be like teenagers, if I'm making a bath, I always use nice oils for their bath as well. I don't do it for the kids, but for the little ones, but for the big two, I'll like dim the lights. I'll set it all up nicely for them because I feel like they need that space too. But maybe I'm sort of being a bit vicariously. It's like, I'd quite like someone to do that for me.
And what about you? What are your favourite products? What can you not live without? Or what would you always replace when it ran dry?
I mean, I must admit, I'm pretty low maintenance. But I think, I mean, in terms of sun cream is the big one, probably. We've just come back from our family holiday, actually. And I always count it as a success if no one can tell I've been away, because I can't get a tan. So I have to go for just definitely not burning. So I'm a factor 50. And for the last few years, actually, we've used this Bioderma one. I don't know if you've seen it, but it's a kid's one that comes as a foam, like a mousse. Mm-hmm. And it's excellent. I haven't had any issues with any of the kids' skin. It's sometimes quite hard to get hold of, but I really rate it. And it's quite soft and it doesn't feel too heavy. It doesn't give me like spots and things like that. So I really like that stuff. Always replace that. And then for my things, I mean, I'm actually happy with quite basic stuff, really. I like quite uncomplicated things because I used to use a lot of heavy things when I was younger. I tried the sort of more intensive night creams and oils and things, and my skin actually doesn't like it. It's mm-hmm. a bit heavy. So just things that are quite sort of, they smell nice and they feel quite fresh. I have got some Estee Lauder, but I've also got some Nivea, some Simple, really stuff that's not trying too hard, really. I just want something that just moisturizes and feels nice. And ditto for cleansers and things, really. It's always the eyelash glue I have trouble taking off because I use false eyelashes for gigs. So I'm always stuck with a little bit. I looked at myself this morning. I've taken everything off now. But when I came off the tour bus, I'd had to get ready in the dark to go to bed because the kids are already asleep. So I'd sort of done it what I thought was a good job. And I looked at myself and I was like, whoa, I had like glitter everywhere, bits of eyelash glue. So that's all gone now. It's just nice feeling fresh. I haven't got any makeup on at all right now and it feels lovely.
It does feel so lovely. Are you somebody who would always try and take everything off before you hit the hay?
No, I have to be honest with you. I know the answer. I know the answer is supposed to be yes, but I'm actually really bad with that. I'll pretty much always cleanse my skin, but eye makeup, I quite like the way it sinks in. And if I've had like a professional makeup artist do my makeup, and I'll try and preserve the eye makeup for, I'll try and get at least another day out of it. I'm shameless.
No, it's heartbreaking, isn't it, when somebody does your makeup so perfectly? It's heartbreaking kind of swiping some cotton wool over it, and you just think, and the bottom line is eyeliner just looks better on day two, doesn't it?
Oh, it does. It really does. And I've even had it where I've managed to keep false eyelashes on for an extra day if you manage to sleep like facing up, because otherwise you get one side that's good and the other side that's gone like all
this one's gone a bit skewer.
But yeah, I mean, my mum despairs because when I was small, she was always, you know, cleanse, tone, moisturize. But we have different skin. I used to have really bad, very spotty skin. In fact, I once got dumped by someone for having spotty skin when I was a teenager. So now I've known less works for me better. Yeah, well,
that
it was awful.
That was nice of him.
That's lovely, wasn't it?
Did he just blatantly say, you're too spotty, you got to go?
He did, actually. It's all right. I think we'd only had a snog. It's fine. I don't think it was going anywhere. I went to the doctors and got some, I don't know what they were, some awful, huge, big red tablets to try and control it. Now, my skin was bad for years. So I think now I have understood that it likes it when I don't do too much, really. Yeah, and if I leave makeup on for long, it won't like that either. So now I just, keep it quite Spartan.
Now, I know you won't mind me saying you're in your 40s. You're in an industry where women, I mean, hopefully less so, but are still expected to be evergreen. Talk to me about your relationship with that, even if you have one?
I'm actually quite loud and proud about my age. I really like getting older. I'm 43 now, and I didn't really like my decades. When I entered my 30s, I knew I was going to like it. I had a great time in my 30s. I loved it. And as I approached 40s, I thought, I don't really have a sense of what that is yet. And then I think I've understood that being in your 40s seems to be about being a bit more unapologetic, because you've just sort of, you just know where you're at. And it's so lovely shrugging off any bits of, you know, what other people think about the decisions you make or how you live your life. And, you know, I'm still really curious about the world and excited about possibilities, but I'm also very settled in the things that I like and how they work for me and the people around me and who I work with and all of that stuff. So I think 40s are great. I think in a lot of ways I've probably felt even more empowered as time's got on, really. I definitely feel still really good when I'm on stage. And I don't know, I think I'm very comfortable with getting older. I don't expect to look young forever. I've never been chasing that. I've never dabbled with anything. And so I understand that the baton of youth, you just got to pass it on, right? You don't own that. And I'd like to look a nice version of where I'm at, but I'm not expecting that to be a young version of where I'm at, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And I think it's changing a bit. It's changing at snail's pace, but I do think it's probably very different from when, for example, your mother's career was at a similar stage.
Yeah, definitely.
Women I think were sent out to pasture, weren't they?
Yeah, definitely. And I think we're, as you say, it's still snail's pace, but you're starting to see older women represented in a way that's giving them, like, actually they do have a whole life, you know, and there's just a lot of really fantastic women in their 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s out there still going strong, doing cool stuff. So yeah, and I feel it's quite sad when people have an uncomfortable relationship with getting older, because without sounding too twee about it, it's still a privilege. It is, you know.
Well, it's a lot better than the alternative.
It is, exactly.
I always want to know about people's girlfriends, and you mentioned them, so tell me all about them.
Oh, wow. I mean, well, they're just the best people, aren't they? You're good friends, because it's that thing where you just pick up where you left off every time. And so my closest girlfriends, probably still ones from, if not from school, then at least from around that era. So I've got friends I've known for at least 20 years and some for 30 years. So I've got a best friend called Maria, who was at school with me, and we speak all the time. She lives in Bristol now and I'm in London, but we message each other. We sort of keep a check on how we're all doing, and we always know what's going on in each other's lives. And then, yeah, I've got other girlfriends from school. Not so many now, but they're the ones that I do have are really close. And then lots of friends that I work with as well. So I kind of fell on my feet with, when I did my first solo video for Take Me Home, I worked with a makeup artist called Louise Constad and a hairdresser called Lisa Lauder. And they're still like some of my best friends, and we see each other all the time and I still work with them. I just love that shorthand you have with people you've known a long time. And what's nice as well there is that we're actually three different generations of women, but we can all sit around a table and talk about stuff and our different perspectives, and there's lots and lots of common ground. And then I don't know how common this is, but my mum and I have quite a few friends in common as well. We've got, I can think of at least two girlfriends that are really close to me, but they also are close to my mum, and they're just as likely to go out for lunch with her as they are with me. So that's nice. And there's a whole bunch of folk, and I suppose all the people I'm in my band with as well, and all the girls that work with me there, and bits of my, you know, my brother's mates, my sister's mates. It's quite an amorphous crew, I'd say, but it makes for good birthdays.
Yeah. I've known Louise Constad since I was 14. She's an absolutely brilliant makeup artist, and I will put her social details in the program notes, as well as Lisa Laudart, so you guys can follow them, because they are both extremely, extremely talented. Louise Constant has done everybody.
And she's done, got some good stories.
She's got some good stories, and she has amazing ability. And so I will put those details down below, as well as any product specifics, the sun care Sophie mentioned, and so on, so that you can go find them. So you mentioned some brilliant artists there that you work with, but you're also a dab hand yourself, right? With makeup?
Well, I don't know about that, but obviously I've worked with some brilliant people, and so, you know, you basically get to pick up tips along the long way. And I think I do my makeup the way that probably I was taught when I first started doing my solo videos, just how to sort of layer it up. And I really enjoy it, and I try and do my makeup differently for every gig. I've obviously got things I always like to do, like a black tick, a bright lip, but actually I don't really want to fall into a rut. And so when I do my shows, I always get myself ready. All my live gigs, the makeup is always me. And sometimes I've had people offer, you know, they'll say, oh, can I come, you know, I'll come and do your hair for you. I'll do your makeup. I don't actually want that. I really like having that space. So I'll maybe have just, I don't need long, let's say an hour. I'll heat my rollers up and then just, I'll just sit there and get all my makeup and out and I'll be like, right, what is it today? And I'll pick a color for my eyes and just sort of go from there. And I feel like that's when I get time to really like process, you know, the gig I'm doing, kind of, I suppose it kind of gets you in the moment really. And you just think about, right, what do I want to talk about on stage? What's significant about tonight? When I was doing my UK tour in March, it would be when I would learn, this is a bit weird, but I'd learn facts about the area I was in. So I'd maybe learn like, let's say 3 or 4 slightly unusual facts about, I don't know, let's say Nottingham or whatever, so that I had stuff to talk about on stage. But I'd be doing that while I was getting ready. And I think my brain just needs a shift in gear. I mean, particularly like the weekend, I was with all the kids at this festival. We did 2 festivals. I brought my 3-year-old, my 6-year-old, my 10-year-old, a friend for the 10-year-old. So, you know, 4 kids, lots going on. But that hour is like, right, I'm getting ready now. And they bustle in and out, but I really just need that quiet time. And they can't talk to me when I'm putting my eyelashes on because then I just, it'll go wrong.
This sort of reminds me of lots of women really. Okay, most women don't get up on stage. Most women don't have to wear show makeup or have an hour to get ready. But I do think for lots of women, that's their one moment in the day when they are alone with themselves, having a kind of contemplative moment of self-reflection in a way.
Definitely. And it's a gear shift and you just look at yourself and you're like, right. And I think they call it flow, don't they? When you're engaged in a task that's demanding enough that that's the only task you're doing, thank you very much. But it's gives you freedom in your brain to sort of explore other things. And for me, those anchors, like it might be when you're in the shower, it might be when you put your makeup on, it might be when you're walking back from the school run, all those little moments are, that's your time to be, you know, you don't have to be available to other people because you're committed to the thing you're doing and it's a necessity. You've got to get from A to B. You've got to finish having your shower, whatever it may be. But it just gives you time just to think about the day, think about what you need to do, you know, prioritize. I find that invaluable. I don't make notes really. I don't write stuff down. So for me, that's when I get in my head and I'm like, right, where are my thoughts at? I really need it.
It's also an act of self-care, isn't it? Sort of touching your face, adorning your face is an act of self-love, self-care, I think, for lots of us.
Yeah, I suppose that's true, actually, really. And just checking in with yourself. And, you know, like most of us, we probably don't really look at yourself the rest of the day, do you? You just kind of leave the mirror in the morning and then you're just like, right, into the next thing. So it's that bit of just having a bit of a check-in with yourself is really important. So, yeah, I do really like that time. And obviously before a gig, it just gives me a chance just to get a bit present, because otherwise you know, it's a horrible feeling if you walk on stage thinking, oh golly, I haven't really thought about the fact I'm about to do a gig. I like to have a bit of a like, right, where am I? What's the vibe here? You know, is there anything, I'm my father's daughter sometimes. I'm like, what stupid jokes am I going to make? You know, I've got to have like a couple of things prepared. Otherwise I feel like it'll probably make me nervous, but I don't get nervous anymore. But yeah.
And what do you think your signature beauty look is? I suppose when I think of you, I think of glitter and a bold lip and big lashes and liner. I think of show makeup. Do you know what I mean? I think of either no makeup or show makeup. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think that's pretty fair. And I think, I mean, the glitter's kind of come back into my life. I went away. I used to have glitter tons at the beginning. When I did Murder on the Dance Floor, I had all the glitters. And then I totally went away from glitter for a while, not least because you know what it's like. It gets everywhere. But then the last year or so, I got the big bag of glitter back out again. And I was like, oh, wow, I've got tons. And so when I was doing my tour in March, I did a different color glitter every night. I was like, yay, all the rainbow. And yeah, I think my signature is probably a bright eye makeup as well. Like even if I've got glitter, I'll go blue or lilac or green or something. I love a really bright eyeshadow, especially on stage. Like you've got to go a little bit caricature. It's not supposed to look like normal life.
Yeah, and also it's got to show up, right? There's no point wearing like a kind of pretty nude face when you've got thousands of people, many of whom are like several hundred feet away, you know.
Exactly. And it makes you feel like you've got into sort of you've just kind of made it something a bit bigger than life. And then once you're in that outfit, once you're wearing the makeup, once your hair's done, it's like, right, I've got to perform now. You'd feel more silly if you didn't sing. So it's like, you've got to get out there.
I worked with Catherine Ryan once, and she, like you, likes that kind of big face when she's performing. And I remember she said to me, well, you know, if people are buying a ticket, if people are spending money on childcare and spending money on a ticket to come and see you, you've got to give them a bit of razzle dazzle. And I thought, that's right. You know, you've got to turn it out.
Whatever your version of making an effort is. And I suppose, again, harking back to what we were talking about at the beginning with, you know, the 90s, I looked around and I saw it was really the norm to look, to just jump up on stage wearing whatever you'd walked in. And so you'd see bands all dressed in jeans and t-shirts. And I was like, that just doesn't look very exciting to me. Like, if you're saying everybody look at me, like, I want to be like, okay, yeah, I'm the one in like head to toe sequins. Thank you very much. You know, like, you might as well make a bit of a thing of it. It's kind of fun. And it doesn't look like you're a show off. It just looks like you're saying, ta-da, like, let's have some fun together. I've made an effort. You don't need to worry about anything because I've got this. I'm going to set the tone and let's just see if we can all ride the wave together.
And were you always glad you were a girl in that sense?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I suppose yes. And I suppose I've always been very interested in, it's, you know, when I think of all people that have inspired me, I think it's women, really. I can't think of, I mean, obviously there are men that I think look incredible and awesome, but I think the ones that really got me as a child and really made me like get that kind of excitement and like, and be mesmerized and think, I can't look away, but I don't know what it is I love. You know, I think of like my Cindy doll's face, or I think of, movies I would watch, or music videos, Tony Basil doing Hey Mickey. Like, although actually that did make me think, I also had Adam Ant and Mark Almond on there as well. So maybe there are a few blokes that snuck in as well. There's so many amazing people out there. I mean, I get inspired all the time. I love watching people perform, and I love it when people have really gone to town and they just own it. I absolutely love it. There's something completely addictive and wonderful about that confidence. It's just kind of glorious.
Me too. Love a costume change. You mentioned getting ready before your shows as a bit of a kind of me moment to really have to yourself. But are you also a fan of getting ready with friends?
Oh, yes. God, that's amazing. I mean, you're getting ready, that takes me back to like getting ready to go clubbing as a teenager. It's always better than the night out. It's the best bit of the night. It's the what might happen. It's the, you know, oh, can you chuck me your eyeliner? It's the, oh, that looks really good on you. It's trying different outfits. Should I wear this one or this one? It's all the chat. Yeah, I love all that. And obviously it doesn't happen as much as I would like anymore, but when it does, it's really fun. Really, really fun.
It's blessed.
I love getting ready for a night out. I really love it. I love the glamour of it. I've always kind of found that really exciting.
It holds so much promise, doesn't it? It's almost disappointing to then have to go out.
Yeah, exactly. I know. But you kind of know that, but you still fall for it every time, don't you? Like, no, this is the night.
Tell me what you would put on a playlist as the perfect getting ready song.
Ooh.
I think music's very important when you're getting ready.
It is. I mean, I suppose something that kind of like gently seduces you into a state of like excitement. So you've got to get your heart rate up a tiny bit, haven't you? I mean, it's probably a bit of a cliche for me to say so, but I did think of really classic disco just because it's kind of unashamed. It's not, it just woos you. Its sole intent is to woo you. It's not trying to do anything else. It's just like, let me get your shoulders moving. Let me get your feet tapping, your hips wiggling. It's like, it just has one intent, and it's to make you want to dance.
Yeah, bit of Sylvester on. You have no option, do you? You have no option but to just kind of start moving and have fun.
Exactly, exactly.
That's it for this episode. Thank you so much to Sophie Ellis-Bexter for putting her best face forward.
Please subscribe and follow Beyond the Bathroom wherever you get your podcasts. And if you enjoy the show, please leave a rating and a review. And I will see you next time. Bye. Insanity Group.